if it can't handle the best we have here, I really have my doubts that it can handle even a little adversity in the Arctic.
Investigating Shell's failed oil containment dome system. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 30th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Palmer residents describe tense moments waiting to hear about yesterday's fire.
The hardest part of the whole experience was, wondering if the fire was going to reach the house.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Get a career in less than a year in nursing or QMed or professional cooking and baking. Additional programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January, so enroll now. This message sponsored by Avtech.
Shell Oil has been building and testing equipment designed for the Arctic Ocean in Puget Sound. In September, a key test of underwater oil spill equipment was a spectacular failure. It forced the energy giant to postpone Arctic oil drilling until next summer. Shell and its federal regulators have been tight-lipped about the failed test, but Freedom of Information requests reveal what happened beneath the surface of Puget Sound. John Ryan reports from Public Station KUOW in Seattle.
Before Shell can drill for oil in the Arctic Ocean, it needs to prove to federal officials that it's able to clean up a massive oil spill there. That proof hinges on a barge being built in Bellingham called the Arctic Challenger. The barge is only one component of Shell's plans for handling oil spills off the remote north coast of Alaska, but the Obama administration won't let oil drilling get underway until the 36-year-old barge and its brand new oil spill equipment are in place. On board the Arctic Challenger is something that looks kind of like an underwater vacuum cleaner. It's called a containment dome. If efforts to cap a blown-out well don't work, the dome can capture spewing oil and funnel it to a tanker near the surface. The Arctic Challenger passed several Coast Guard tests for seaworthiness, but it was a different story when its oil spill system was put to the test near Anacortes. A federal agency known as BSEE, that's the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, required that test. According to BSEE internal emails, the containment dome test was supposed to take about a day. But on the first day, the massive steel dome comes unhooked from some winches used to maneuver it underwater. Shell has to recover it and repair it. On the second day, a remote-controlled submarine gets snagged in some anchor lines. It takes divers about 24 hours to untangle it. But on the fifth day, the test has its worst accident. It's a dead calm Friday night, and BSEE official Mark Fessmeyer is on board the Challenger. He's watching underwater video being sent back from the remote control submarine. A little after midnight, the video screen suddenly fills with bubbles. The 20-foot-tall containment dome then shoots to the surface. The massive white dome breached like a whale, in Mark Fessmeyer's words. Then it sinks back down. About 12 hours later, the crew of the Challenger manages to get the dome back to the surface. Its top half has been crushed like a beer can, again in Mark Fessmeyer's words. Spokespeople for Shell and for BSEE declined to answer questions or allow interviews about the mishaps. In an email, Shell spokeswoman Kelly Optuve said the dome was damaged when a faulty electrical connection caused it to descend too quickly. Environmentalists say the Arctic Challenger's multiple problems show that Shell isn't prepared for an Arctic oil spill. One of those environmentalists is Todd Guyton. He lives on Seahome Hill in Bellingham. His condo overlooks the port where the Challenger has been under construction for a year now.
Just look out our window and there it is.
He says the top half of the steel dome came back from its sea trial crumpled like a piece of paper.
It failed in very calm, tranquil conditions in the best time of the year up here in the Pacific Northwest. And if it can't handle the best we have here, I really have my doubts that it could handle even a little adversity in the Arctic.
2 months later, Shell is still rebuilding the dome. The company wouldn't say when the Arctic Challenger will be ready for testing again. Earlier in November, the Obama administration called for more research into handling oil spills in the far north. The Arctic Research Commission said oil spill tests need to be done in the Arctic Ocean and that federal regulators need more staff or more time to properly vet proposals for offshore drilling at the top of the world. I'm John Ryan in Seattle.
Alaska's congressional delegation is pushing defense authorization bill amendments aimed at protecting Eielson Air Force Base from downsizing. In floor testimony this morning, Senator Lisa Murkowski said some key questions need to be answered before the Air Force moves ahead on an environmental impact statement on the proposed relocation of Eielson's F-16 squadron to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage.
Whether or not it makes any sense at all to throw Eielson under the bus, given its considerable strategic upside potential. And the second is whether the Air Force will truly achieve any cost savings by walking away from Eielson or simply transferring costs someplace else.
Senator Murkowski said an EIS also will not answer the question of whether or not it makes sense to abandon a community that's more than willing to accommodate Air Force training. Eielson is in proximity to a massive military training zone. The community of Palmer is resting a lot easier now that a fire that burned Thursday is out. Dozens of people spent yesterday afternoon and evening at the Palmer Senior Center worrying that the blaze might burn their homes. But as KSKA's Dacia Eaton explains, no homes were burned and the damage was minimal.
The blaze started Thursday afternoon when a truck hauling a trailer caught on fire after an accident on Palmer Fishhook Road near the Glen Highway. The ground was dry, with no snow, and high winds quickly spread flames through brush to about 150 to 200 acres. Officials say a couple of outbuildings, a vehicle, and a camping trailer, as well as a backyard playground, burned, but no homes were lost. Rick Downing lives in the Cedar Hills subdivision. He was in Anchorage when he got a call about the fire. He rushed toward home, but roads were blocked, and he was directed to the Palmer Senior Center.
The hardest part of the whole experience was, you know, wondering if the fire was going to reach the house.
Downing was eventually allowed into his home briefly to grab personal items and a pet.
We were here maybe 2 minutes. I grabbed our parakeet, and our grandkids love that parakeet, so I figured better grab it, and a few computers and some personal belongings, and just headed to the senior center.
Downing says he got the news his house was okay and was allowed to return home around 8 o'clock. He was relieved to find the only sign of the fire was a smoky smell.
We could smell the smoke, but it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be, at least in the house. The garage is smelled a little smokier, but and it still has somewhat of a smoke smell too, but I think that'll go away.
And he says there was an upside to the ordeal.
Mostly it was just sitting around the senior center and getting to know neighbors that we'd talked to before, but had never really spent a lot of time talking to. So that part was, you know, really good.
Really good, he says, especially if there's ever another emergency. Stephanie Bass is with the Red Cross of Alaska. She helped coordinate the command post and shelter at the Palmer Senior Center, where 40 or so residents evacuated.
I just want to say I couldn't believe amazing outpouring from Palmer, from the citizens right around local, and all the firemen that came out from many areas. It was fantastic to see how everybody pulled together. People that, you know, I don't even know, just came in, and people brought food or people just called in to see what they could do. So that was really great.
Firefighters with the Division of Forestry are continuing to monitor the area, officials say, and they're asking residents to refrain from any outdoor burning while a high wind warning is in effect through the weekend. Officials say the smoke and dust from the fire has made air quality worse. There's also an air quality advisory in effect for Palmer and Wasilla. The elderly, children, and those with respiratory issues are advised to stay indoors until the wind subsides. In Anchorage, I'm Dacia Eaton.
Facing sexual assault charges, Sergei Chukwak has resigned from the board of Bristol Bay Native Corporation, where he had served since 2010. BBNC board chair Joseph Chithluk said in a written statement today that Chukwak's decision to voluntarily resign will allow the board to focus on effectively serving its shareholders. The state has charged Chukwak with sexual assault from an incident that happened on November 5th in Naknek. His alleged victim is deceased, and the state has yet to determine how the case against Chukwak will proceed without the victim's testimony. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the potential effects of the humpback whale baby boom.
The amazing thing is that there's not more issues. There's a lot of cruise ships, a lot of whales, there's a lot of gear in the water.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the Quality Inn and Suites on Spinard, close to the airport in downtown Anchorage, offering Wi-Fi, a hot continental breakfast, and a 24-hour airport shuttle. Reservations at 243-3131.
Many Alaska locations are ending up the month with minimal snow. National Weather Service climate data shows Fairbanks and Anchorage 13 inches below normal, with 6 inches on the ground in Fairbanks and just 2 in Anchorage. Cover is bare to minimal at Bethel, McGrath, Nome, Kotzebue, and even the state's unofficial snow capital of Valdez.
Windblown, exposed rocks, patches of old snow. It's just not very good.
That's longtime Valdez ski guide Matt Kinney. Kinney says it's not unusual for a slow start to the snow season in town, but what he's talking about is the winter playground on Thompson Pass.
We had a really great snowfall the first week of October. We had 4 feet on Thompson Pass, and we thought we were off to one of our great epic ski seasons, but that quickly disappeared, and now we're down to no skiing at all.
Scant snowfall over much of the Alaska in recent weeks is attributed to the jet stream. National Weather Service meteorologist Scott Berg in Fairbanks says the upper atmospheric winds have been set up in what's referred to as a blocking pattern.
We've had a big ridge of high pressure out over the west coast, and then a trough of low pressure to our east. And with that kind of a setup, we end up with a dry flow from the north, and it's just not very conducive to moving weather systems.
Berg says no immediate change is forecast, but he expects the jet stream to reconfigure into a pattern more conducive to snow sometime in early December. The Fairbanks North Star Borough unveiled a new air quality community action program during a meeting in North Pole Thursday night. The program encourages residents to voluntarily refrain from burning wood on days when air quality is poor. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough has reported a very unhealthy air quality index in North Pole for most of the week. That's why borough officials decided to unveil a new air quality community action program there. Borough air quality manager Dr. Jim Connor told an audience of roughly 20 people that residents need to take responsibility for the problem.
You know, blaming the inversions is like blaming gravity for being overweight.
Borough officials are asking area residents to voluntarily cut back on burning wood when air quality is poor. Wood burning accounts for more than half of the fine particulate matter that's contributing to a thick haze currently hanging over the region. Borough Chief of Staff Jeff Jacobson says beyond sub-zero temperatures this week, conditions are prime for dangerous levels of pollution.
What I would consider a perfect storm, we have the EPA guidelines that we have to meet by 2014, have the plan done. We have super high energy costs, which are placing a greater demand and stress on families to find cheaper ways to heat their homes and to pay their electric bill, which is, of course, increasing the use of wood and coal, which, if you're using inefficient stoves, adds to the air quality problems.
When residents sign up for the new borough-wide program, they'll receive a text message, phone call, or email on days when air quality is poor. The advisory asks residents to voluntarily turn to a heating source other than wood for at least 24 hours. Dr. Jim Connor estimates that if volunteers switch to heating oil, it will cost them roughly $10 a day.
And really the only way that we have to fix this problem is to reduce the emissions that we put out with our home heating. It's the only thing that we can do.
Connor says the borough would be well on its way to solving its air quality woes if at least 7,800 households sign up and respond to the alerts. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Juneau has perhaps the tightest housing market in the state. The average assessed value of the capital city's single-family homes is nearly $350,000. Rents are also among the highest in the state. The average rental unit in Juneau currently goes for more than $1,150 a month. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, the Juneau Assembly's new ad hoc housing committee met for the first time yesterday to lay the foundation for a day-long work workshop on barriers to new housing construction in the capital city.
The idea is to have three or four panels, each representing a segment of the housing industry, come together for a day to tell the assembly what's preventing construction of new units in Juneau. It's the brainchild of Assemblymember Randy Wanamaker, who's organizing the event.
What are the problems that they face in trying to provide housing in this community from their perspective as lenders or builders or property owners or real estate people? And what do they think the assembly can do about it?
Housing is the number one reason the capital city has the highest cost of living of the state's three largest metropolitan areas, according to the Juneau Economic Development Council's annual Economic Indicators report. The city has an affordable housing commission, but Wanamaker says the workshop should focus on all aspects of housing.
There's a need for all housing in this community. There's some housing that's in less shortage than others, but we're not limiting ourselves to studying one segment. We're trying to learn what prevents housing from happening across the spectrum.
Assemblymember Carlton Smith is a commercial real estate broker. He says Wanamaker's approach could benefit the industry just as much as the assembly.
All of these folks work well with each other in the industry, but this will be the first time, I believe, that they will be brought together in this kind of a forum to talk about Juneau's unique set of challenges when it comes to providing housing.
Juneau's Deputy Community Development Director Greg Cheney says the city has taken a number of steps in recent years to encourage new development.
Between the rezoning and the increase in density allowed in these various zoning districts, we have 18,000 potential units more than we did just 2 years ago.
So what's stopping people from building in Juneau? Cheney says financing is still hard to come by due to the national recession. As for things the city can do better, he says education is key. For example, Cheney says a builder recently came to see him, wondering if he was allowed to put more than 15 units on a light commercial lot.
And they were pretty sheepish about it because they didn't think it was allowed. And I said, no, you can do 30. And that was really surprising for them. And these are active builders and property owners in town right now. When I realized that they didn't know about it, I was thinking, boy, what about the folks that are just, you know, kind of average folks? They don't get notices in the mail. They don't know that these are possibilities. So I think we have a real opportunity for public education right now.
Wanamaker agrees the city can do a better job of outreach.
Sharing that information, letting them know that some solutions have already been implemented is probably a very good idea.
For now, Wanamaker will focus on recruiting people to serve on the various industry panels. He hopes to schedule the workshop for sometime in January to allow potential changes to be discussed before the 2013 construction season. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Aaron Selvig. This week on AK, humpback whales. There's a baby boom going on with Alaska's humpback whales. Slow but steady population growth is good news for the species, as well as whale watchers. But it could be bad news for boaters, hatcheries, and the herring fleet. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld learned some of the details at this month's Sitka Whale Fest Science Symposium. He filed this report.
There's a few more whales further out. Not sure if they're whales we've had close views of yet this morning, but we'll find that out.
Captain John Dunlap pilots a catamaran through a protected area of Sitka Sound. The vessel usually carries tourists on summertime wildlife watching trips, but this outing is different. Half a dozen expert marine scientists are on board.
Population increase in humpbacks is going gangbusters.
Jan Straley tells passengers about whales over the catamaran's public address system. She's science director for WhaleFest, hosted by the Sitka Sound Science Center. She's best known as a University of Alaska professor who studied humpbacks for more than 30 years.
They are reproducing at 6 to 7% a year in southeastern Alaska, so that means for every 100 whales, we get 6 or 7 more whales the next year. And their mortality rate isn't that high, so we're just getting more and more whales, which is a good thing, but it also comes with some problems.
Those problems aren't evident this day. Passengers gather on deck to watch, photograph, and hear some of the sounds spouting humpbacks. But researchers say trouble's ahead as the population grows. Numbers are up as the species continues recovering from commercial whaling. John Moran is a research biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service in Juneau.
The amazing thing is that there's not more issues. There's a lot of cruise ships, a lot of whales, there's a lot of gear in the water.
Whales do get hit and killed by the big ships, and they do become tangled in commercial fishing lines. But Moran is more worried about interactions between whales and skiffs, cabin cruisers, and other small vessels.
People don't really pay attention when they're driving boats like they do when they're driving a car. And small boats are fast, and whales are big, and it's like hitting a brick wall, and I don't think people fully realize that.
Passengers watch several whales arch their backs, show their tails, and dive. Captain Dunlap asks everyone to keep their eyes open.
We're in relatively deep water. It's over 350 feet deep here. Depending on where these whales are feeding, they could be down for quite a while.
Some people think humpbacks eat only krill, a small shrimp-like crustacean filtered out by their baleen. But Straley tells the whale watchers they also feed on fish.
There's a nice layer of herring right on the bottom that's about 80 fathoms deep. So these whales come right now and they're feeding prior to their migration, just bulking up because they don't feed a lot in Hawaii.
That's where most Sitka whales go during winter months. Some also swim from Prince William Sound and other locations to Mexican waters. Research shows the growing humpback population eats enough herring to reduce local stocks. Moran says they take about 20% of the biomass in Prince William Sound, about the same as the commercial harvest before the Exxon Valdez disaster. He says the whales may be slowing herring recovery since the oil spill. And he says humpbacks are very effective herring hunters.
The whales dive down into the school, and more whales come. They start breaking up this big school into smaller schools, and fish get stunned, and the fish are scattering. It's a lot easier for a sea lion.
That's another impact of humpback population growth. Their feeding helps other marine mammals, as well as birds, which sometimes follow whales. Then there's the salmon hatcheries. At Baranoff Island's Hidden Falls and a few other sites, whales have learned to feed on newly released fry.
One thing they're really good at is being maneuverable. They have those really long pectoral fins, and that allows them to turn really sharp, so they can get in really close to shore, and they can work around the net pens, and they figure out this is a great place to eat.
Marine scientists continue to study humpback population growth and what it might mean for the ocean ecosystem as well as people. But on this cruise, more whales just means more photos. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka Sound.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to the native village of Eyak. The village of Eyak is no longer populated, but the native village of Eyak in Cordova is a federally recognized tribe.
I'm LaRue Barnes, and I'm the Cultural Center Director and the Museum Director for the Native Village of Eyak. Our territory was a cultural crossroads, including four tribes, the Eyak people, Chugach-Ilutik, Tlingit, and Athabaskan. And the traditional homeland is like the Copper River Delta, Prince William Sound, and Gulf Coast territory. People just became kind of integrated with the family, with the white people that were here. And then at one point, the land that was where there was an Eyak village along the lake, that land was sold by the person who was the chief at the time, and it was sold to a white person, and it became a trader court. At the museum here, we're putting together our story. We have a lot of artifacts that are from village members and other people in town that have donated. We have a Sea Lion vest that's on loan, a grass-covered bottle collection, and that was very much out of Catella, which is an archaeological site a little ways down the coast, but that was within our traditional homeland. We have living elders that were born there, but it's now just an archaeological site. Our culture is kind of, in a lot of ways, it's been on a revival. We have the Alaska Native Settlement Claims Act. It kind of redrew and confused some boundaries, but it helped other things. And then we have our own incorporation as a tribe. And I think in a lot of ways, there's been almost like a renaissance because we have our crafts, we have our history, and we have our artifacts coming back to us. And that's all brought Native pride back.
LaRue Barnes is the museum director for the Native Village of Eyak. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ed Schoenfeld, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Aaron Selvig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Seattle, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.